Hello, Bob. Bob, we're on. We're on. This is the 26th of our dialogues. And, Bob, I don't normally do this. I want to play you a very short recording of someone else. Because what they are saying reminds me of parts of what you say that probably I have problems with and don't agree with. But this might be a bridge over to them. And it's from a radio show which happens on community radio in Regina in Canada, and it's presented by Ken Fox. It's Ken Fox's voice, and he calls it Naval Aviation in Audio, and he plays local hardcore bands and recites poetry, and the title is obviously a reference to Frank Zappa. It's Naval Aviation in Art, an instrumental piece he wrote, which is brief and quiet. And it's only just occurred to me, because Ken's making me think about it again, that naval aviation, I always took it to be about the Navy and the sea and the flying. And of course, the naval is your navel. It's navel gazing. So it's being able to, via internal subjectivity, to get somewhere in flight. And this is what he said suddenly. I found it quite shocking because he's talking about suicide.
This is indeed a show to kill yourself to. But no, no, not your animal self. Not your corporeal being in the universe. No, please don't kill that, your earthly sailing vessel. Nope. This is a show to help you destroy the prison of identity, embodied in resumes, class photographs, bank accounts, and above all, personal property. Kill the specter of identity that shackles the imagination, which is immortal.
Okay, I disagree with what he's saying, but that's doesn't matter. It's a bunch of words to interact with.
Why not? I like hearing you disagree. It make a change.
Yeah. Oh, good, good.
Tell me your disagreements. It's poetic communism. He's saying get rid of private property. He's saying get rid of that sense of self, which is your career. And surely this is what you've done, Bob, because you've constructed for yourself an unbelievable biography. You've got rid of
the users, the content. They think it's unbelievable. It's all true. Of course, you see, he's complaining about things. He doesn't know that that's what the CIA does. We give up identities and we change. We give up personal property. We floating free over the planet on expense accounts. So, you know, you have to take the context of who's listening to that. The people that we assume in Regina are hearing this. I don't think they should give up their identities. They should inflate them. They should get more powerful and take back their power. Mm. Why suicide yourself? And then maybe I'd say, yeah, physically suicide yourself, because I don't believe that we die. I think we transition. And I've had Ion on the radio a lot, and Ion says every death is a suicide. And we were explaining that on the show, the other show today.
Well, this has tipped us into complete nonsenseville. So you were saying that some people appreciate it when I get cross on this show. So now I'm completely furious because because of this absolutely crass way in which your countercultural medical way of interpreting things has misinterpreted what Ken is arguing about, because he's talking about.
You ask me to disagree, but I can shift in. That's just one interpretation. Let me do a couple others. McLuhan used to say, you don't like those ideas? I got lots of others. And that means like a totally different view. And so he's saying that I say imagination is embedded in your identity and your property. Mm. And you need to see through the limitations of your imagination, because you're projecting and creating your own subjective reality, and it's the instruments and external world around you that does that. That's your imagination in action. People need to kill their imagination in that sense, not their body. You know, what did he want us to kill? All the IDs. No, don't. Those are gone. Here in the United States, nobody lives with an ID. They get credit cards, they lose them, they get them back again. And right now, nobody knows who they are, what they are, or what money is, or anything. We've arrived at that revolutionary state that Ken's advocating. But of course, it's not a revolution. Where do you get the revolution out of this? So the he's actually talking to the 1940s.
Oh, well, this is
not
the old...
talking to the 20...
Now we're back in the old that my socialism is dated and you're the postmodernist and you've got beyond it, and yet here in England we're in the middle of a post office. Yeah, but you know, we're in the middle of a post office strike over what the government and the people with money want to do with the post office, which is privatisation in line with what the IMF is telling governments all over the world, that they can't afford to have any services which people actually need. And I see it as very much not that change from the 1930s, and we're back to our old disagreements, aren't we?
I think there should be more strikes. I'm all for it, but I'm also wary of how we're going to determine and get a consensus of where we've arrived once the strikes have implemented. I mean, the communication chaos is the bugaboo. There is no common public space. And so that's the issue I'm bringing up. Marx would bring this up if he was alive. He'd say, "Hey, and you bring it up in your way."
But there's an illogic of money which is connecting everybody to each other and giving us systems of understanding what we have to do. A lot of people feel they have to get up in the morning. If they don't, they won't earn their money and won't be able to live in the way that they want to live. And so they go to work.
That's what Ken is referring to. That's the ID that he wants you to give up, you know, in your bank accounts.
Well, okay. I'm not sure. You see, as usual, I don't have any class differentiation in what you're saying, because to me, he's talking about an illusion that we are private individuals in competition with each other. That's what he's criticising.
I agree that that's an illusion.
And I call it poetic communism because he's trying to find the common interests we all have. He feels the imagination and an attack on the imagination is aligned to a criticism of the way in which our bourgeois identities set us all in conflict with each other. And so
we agree with that. That's right. But what are we going to say to make people do that? To drop their identities? You can't just tell them to do it because
the English
language is not good enough for them.
Yeah, well, that was excerpted from his attempt to do that on a one-hour radio program where he is slightly restricted by the conservative nature of the program. He says he can't make explicit political statements, so he says things in a more poetic or cryptic or extreme form, such as you heard just then. But that is a little comment in the main part of the program is reading a avant-garde text by J.H. Prynne called High Pink on Chrome that was written in 1975 over the final symphonic work written by Edgar Varèse, who's the modernist composer who Frank Zappa adored and I think is the key to understanding Frank Zappa's difference from regular rock and roll. And he feels that by reading these words that he adores the way in which Prynne has tapped part of the brain which registers different discourses clashing in the world outside us, that Prynne tapped that. So he's trying to tip the listeners into a realm where they can see how multifarious and multiple and living the world actually is outside their individual egotistic demand to understand. So I think he is trying to put into practice the revolution we're talking about. And of course you could always mock it and say, well, it's only on community radio and who hears that, but then you can mock any good idea by saying, well, it hasn't gone mass yet. Good ideas are not mass. I mean, that's why they're ideas rather than something substantial. I mean, once they're mass, they are substantial and they're there. They're the streets we walk up and down on.
Okay, well, my first response was it sounded like a disagreement, and that was solid, as it said, but it's not my only idea. I agree with what he's doing. He's enjoying, he's following his fastest path to his joy to communicate this stuff. I have no problem with that. So what if I just say, yeah, great. We have to move on, right?
But I think it's pretty, I'd say it's unique. I don't think it fits into any other attempt to alter things or to state a point of view of the world outside this program itself, actually, Bob.
And what he said, I said many times on the radio 20 years ago in Toronto. Many times. I would add complexities in there explaining how, well, we don't want to give up that bourgeois identity, that visual space that's already gone. We're talking about our new iconic identities we got to give up. And so it was... When I hear something that I've done, then I immediately critique it, so to speak. Mm. You know what I mean? I know it, and it's not new for me, so I start trying to come at another angle. But definitely, if you think that's unique, maybe other people have done it, but I did it all the time, and you can go on my timeline and hear those shows. So I claim what he was doing.
I find it difficult to think that you could ever speak with that degree of fervent, poetic weight that Ken has. You're a different personality, Bob.
Well, maybe I'm different now. Back then, there's hours of it on my timeline. You can hear me ranting. I had 2 hours and very passionate.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I'm probably a little more laid back in relation to you because you're passionate and I'm interested in what you're saying. I think if I started trying to out-passion you, that would cancel the sound out. And I'm being polite here. You have not heard me in other radio shows I do. Aww. I mean, you're not getting all of me on your show, so to speak, or all the ways that I respond to the present.
Aww.
You evoke a certain kind of response in me.
Yeah, and that's mutual. That's the particular unique alchemy that we're pursuing as a possibility of a theoretical development that might shift people towards a different mode of action, isn't it? That we think
yes.
that there's something unleashed when we talk together, however much we formally disagree or however different we are, that something goes on when we think together, which is beyond what we can do individually, and that maybe more people could join in. It could cluster and actually produce a wave going right the way across the world.
Yeah, I agree. You see, the reason I don't speak as much is I've never heard anybody say my stuff back to me until I met you. You know what I mean? The fact that you bring in Wyndham Lewis and The Wake and the Avant-Garde and Zappa Aww. And Marks and McLuhan, all stuff that I've discussed in the past Aww. Only to myself or on the show with my co-host
yeah.
who didn't know what I was talking about. So I'm interested, I'm actually hearing my echo, and that probably puts me in a more reflective response.
Mm.
And that's why when you say a bunch of stuff, and I go, well, that's exactly what I thought. You know?
Well, that's something I'd like to pursue a little bit more. I mean, on the 25th hour that we've done together, the last show that we did, I wanted you to tell me if you thought the avant-garde was dead. And in talking about that, we found a lot of common ground. But the way I'd off mic in our little chat before we switched on the recorder and started doing the show proper, you were saying that a lot of the stuff that we have in common is absolutely unknown to people who listen to the radio or out there. It's simply unknown. So I was wondering if we could explain what this stuff is, as apart from just mentioning names, and actually say what we think it constitutes, or what, how would you describe this stuff to somebody who's never encountered it?
Okay, let's go start off with Finnegan's Wake. What I like to always say to the appropriate audience is that Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print. And someone should hear that if they got any kind of curiosity. Says, well, how could that be? It was written before rock and roll. I said, yeah, that's what's interesting. This is rock and roll in print.
Aww.
That's a loaded statement, so that's what Finney's Wake is.
Aww.
And then Wyndham Lewis disagreed with that. He, and from a very learned, satirical perspective, disagreed with the production that was rock and roll in print. And then that's an interest. There's your debate about whether rock and roll is alive or dead. And then what do we bring in? Then we bring in Karl Marx. Well, a large part of the world studied Karl Marx. That's important. And then you bring in the other guy that influenced everybody, but nobody knows it, and it was suppressed, and that's Marshall McLuhan. You know who he is? No. Well, he's the one that made you think there was a revolution happening on your TV screen, and now that you're bored with. See, so that's how I begin. Now you tell me what you think the four things are. And then there's Frank. I forgot about that. But go ahead.
Mm. Well, I think I always try and explain Finnegan's Wake by actually showing people a page from it. Because have you ever seen a book written in jumbled up words that don't seem to make any sense until you start reading them out loud, which is, I suppose, its relationship to rock and roll, in the sense that it has to be a musical experience before you're allowed to start thinking about it, that if you don't respond to that musical experience, the book is closed to you. You can't read it without mouthing the words, because otherwise you're going to miss all kinds of things which aren't aren't spelled out for you, but are there in the sounds. So
yeah, you've got to sing along with it.
Yeah, you've got to sing along with it. And it produces this... I mean, when you say rock and roll, of course, rock and roll covers a multitude of sins. Yeah, but in its...
I mean rock, music, electrified music.
Yeah, in its original form, I think the blues... And the way that we respond to it is not culturally learned. I think it is physical and fundamental that the particular notes which the blues decides to emphasize will work on any human being anywhere, whatever their cultural baggage or their musical traditions. And that's why it's been the primary weapon for capitalism to break down different cultures all over the world and create a world culture.
That's exactly, and McLuhan said that rock, or blues in the 20s, was the universal Esperanto, or united the world.
Mm.
That's a global language. You're agreeing with McLuhan, he's agreeing with you.
But of course this
and
is
then
very,
you
see,
I... But, though, that allowed the national movements to be subsumed in an entertainment state.
But being a Marxist, having said that, I always like to then divide what I'm talking about in terms of the different positions of capital and labour. And therefore, the blues is used because it has this chthonic basic power that speaks to everybody, but its uses under capitalism, its commodification, actually leads to something completely different and doesn't lead to this unity, but leads to backing tracks for the invasion of Iraq. You know, the rock and rock, or some kind of rock. I hate to call it rock and roll because it's become so... kind of pokey and unsensual, and a different body alignment is implied by it. It's become militarized.
But it also bypasses any grand design on a 1984 level, like George Orwell. If there were some military people who wanted to have a nuclear war or some kind of global conflict and then bring in a world fascism after that, rock as entertainment basic and blues distracted everybody so that they couldn't propagandize. There's the service of the entertainment state. The military couldn't get the old 1984 Orwellian propaganda going because everybody was digging their own rhythm.
Well, I mean, so it's a lot to do with the insubordination in the troops in Vietnam was to do with Hendrix being played and decisions to get into music rather than take seriously the orders of your officer, and the lack of military discipline was very connected with the counterculture and with music.
That's right. The electrified musical blues world creates a tactile dialectic where it's a huge burden on the commodification level, but it's also a freeing. Like, it's beyond the right and left, good and bad dialectic. It moves us into a tactile, strange, involving hypnosis, which can be liberating.
Yeah. I mean, I remember listening to when the Sony Walkman first came in and you had the possibility of good stereo sound while you're moving through the city, the personal... personal stereo, and listening to Electric Ladyland on it, and there being a moment where I realized that this music was making me get off the bus and not go to work, that it was so utopian and lush and luxurious and fantastic that it was inviting me to drop out, quite literally, to not obey the injunction to go to work, And it was the innovation of the personal stereo which brought it home to me again, what this music had meant 10 years before to people.
Okay, so you wrestle with going to work. Now, what's interesting, you walk around and on the subways there, you see everybody with their little earplugs in and their little bubbles, right? And they're all utopian mood. And it's almost like that's frightening as a fragmenting of the public space, so everybody goes and becomes a robot more to keep the unity going. And
well, I noticed this particularly in London, because I do a lot of cycling in London. Cycling sounds like something strenuous where you're sort of going fast, but cycling in London is a way of moving fast, and there's all sorts of interactions because you're continually at traffic lights and making decisions and queuing next to other people and so on. So it's a very social activity, and my idea of being a cyclist is that all cyclists have interests in common, and we like to warn each other about cars or make decisions about where we're going next. And so I like to talk to the people around me. And I find that half of them are complete zombies because they have white wires leading up to their ears and they're listening to a soundtrack. And I can't have a conversation with them because they're listening to some music which is cutting them off from this possibility of an exchange of necessary information and humour and genuine community. So I found the personal stereo quite limiting in terms of what I want to do in London at the minute.
Right, and so you have to realise average people walking around, seeing everybody in their own little tube, I assure you they will complement that, balance it by having hyper uniformity. And I think that's where the Harry Potter fads come in, those kind of consuming one book, is people wanting to have a sense of a unified public space, that there's a common sharing. That is, if you don't like that uniformity, that's a disservice caused by the utopian bubble you have when you have your Walkman listening to Hendrix. You see, this complementary ecology is going on all the time.
Yeah, the opposite springs out what you think could be progressive about something. Although you see, I'm fairly certain that the music being listened to is not anything as anything actually like Hendrix.
But every generation has a certain ear, and they're liking what they're hearing. They're feeling good.
Yeah.
It may not be politically revolutionary. I don't know. Conceptually, it doesn't encourage you to do something, but it does make you feel good. It is a drug. It's the soma of our time. Music is the soma. You know, soma for Brave New World.
Yeah. Yeah, well, music can be the soma, but it can also be it can be something else, and that's what interests me. I mean,
Dumitrescu. Is anybody walking along the streets listening to Dumitrescu, like, you know, what I heard from The Wire?
Yeah.
I think that gives a different reaction.
Well, I think Dumitrescu's moment is now. It's now the Hendrix of our time. And we reached a position last week when we had this hour of talking where we suddenly decided we were into monoculture, that we'd had enough of this pluralistic world where everybody's allowed to do their own thing. And we want a monoculture on a new level, which is the relevance of Finnegan's Wake. Because if everybody read Finnegan's Wake together, it wouldn't unify them in a Harry Potter sense, because there's enough, because the Wake is designed to take the world inside out, and that's why Frank Zappa is very similar to Finnegan's Wake in terms of finding, if you find the correct alignments of culture to reality, you can construct a work of art that is as infinite as reality itself, because you've understood the ways in which reality is structured, and you can build them into your work in such a way as that you yourself are not responsible for everything you're putting in there. But you're allowing the world to cast shadows on the page that you're writing itself, so that it has a kind of objectivity. And I think that is the immortality that Ken Fox is talking about. He's talking about not the private individual seizing of what the world is and then being able to tell people and own that picture, but an opening out that allows the world to fall in, so that when it's examined, you find you thought you were analysing the art and you find you're analysing reality, which is what I find continually with Frank Zappa. And I find it with Joyce. I find it uniquely with them that insofar as I get obsessed with different fragments of it and try and understand them and go for help and read, talk to other people and so on, I find out that by the end of that process, I haven't really found out about Joyce or Zappa. I found out about something in the real world, but with this extra urge within me that isn't bored or alienated from the knowledge of the world, that so often is an obstacle to going out and investigating the world.
Yeah, if I can remember, McLuhan said in his book Take Today, 1972, he ends the book with his solution. He said, over the past 100 years, we've been lulled by the replays of the tribal unconscious. But now with the retrieval of forms of consciousness, it's a resurrection. He makes a pun on it. And so I asked him, what are the recent retrieved forms of consciousness? And he said, Finnegan's Wake. And you take a Finnegan's Wake reading group is a module of a totally ecological situation where people are looking at the same text, but they can hallucinate and project their own things, and they're constantly in a tactile dialectic, noticing the other person's different interpretation than you, but you're also sharing the same space. See, there is an ecology. That's the balance.
Mm.
And but I'm restating what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, this sounds like the kinds of things which a lot of post-Cajun musicians try and do. But for me, it's always tended by a certain kind of...
Listen to this. I just got inspired. That's what's unique about the book. McLuhan used to say in the 50s, what's the role of the book today in the 50s? Knowing it was totally obsolete as a constituent formative medium. But Phineas Wake figured out how to do it, how to keep the book alive. It's a precious experience, and do it in a group session with the Phineas Wake Reading Group. That is a solution to all the conflicts of cultures and their different values. It constantly makes you aware of the ongoing hypersubjectivity or just subjectivity while trying to see if there's a common space or meaning or purpose. I mean, what more perfect environment than that?
Yeah, because it's...
And so if you present a musical thing or a painting or any of the arts, that doesn't work. The book is the only thing, the only medium that can create a homogeneity. But the Wake counters that constantly for each individual. What a marvelous solution.
Mm. Because the thing you're saying about creating a space in which people can exchange things is often the musics I'm interested in get saddled with that idea. And in general, it's a kind of moral injunction that actually prevents me from joining in because I'm impatient with the degree of bullshit going around, which guarantees the community, if you see what I mean. Whereas at a Finnegan's Wake reading group, I am completely challenged myself by every sentence. I'm excited by... words that I see that remind me of other words, and I'm completely exposed and interested and intrigued myself, so I'm really there. And one of the things that gets missed out of the way people talk about cultural objects is the necessity to involve even the very critical or the skeptical. That so often the nice things about culture are celebrated, and then you end up saying, "Yeah, but what's in it if I don't actually like being told that I ought to join in?"
That's right. There's always a point to normal culture. There's no point of view that Joyce is saying, and Joyce even said to me through a medium that he made sure that it was always erased so nobody could find the core meaning under it. And he made sure it was all erased, so there's actually no nothing, but that's not important. You participate with it. And on top of that, the beautiful mesh that he makes of the HCEALP letters going all the way through, he's actually showing how language works in people. The way it's a logos. It holds people together while allowing individual mutation of it. I mean, as McLuhan used to say, what a marvelous creation this is, this book. I mean, he actually solved the communication problems. And then he talks about, Cranley in The Portrait, who was based on Joyce's friend, Jay Byrne. I forget his name.
Okay, yeah.
But he lived at 7 Eccles Street, where Leopold Bloom did. All right? He lived all his life, this J.R. Byrne, J.J. Byrne. And he was he invented code. And he tried to sell his cracking of code and his, perfect cryptography to the Pentagon or whatever it was in the 30s and all this stuff. And then McLuhan points out that there's one section of the first question, from page 126 to 140, the Finn McCool answer, that long section. It describes Finn McCool and the answer is Finn McCool. Remember that?
Yeah.
The beginning of that,
okay.
That section of Finney's Way where it goes through the characters. There's a part in there that Joyce describes the way Prynne or Cranley made this little gadget. The point is that Joyce figured out what Cranley couldn't get. There's a response by Joyce to his buddy. In other words, Joyce created an ecological cryptographic experience commenting on the effort to be cryptographic in secret that Cranley / J. Byrne was trying to sell. Anyways, that's not a known Joycean factor. I mean, it's very little known about that reference to his childhood buddy. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So that, I cite that as how that's what McClellan meant with a marvelous creation. He'd actually solved all the problems of communication to the point you're not asked to be anything like you object to by fitting his leg. You're asked to participate and watch how others participate and become kind of aware.
Yeah, and that's, therefore, it appeals to a certain mentality and a certain mind that doesn't want to follow or adopt another point of view, but is intrigued by actually interesting things. The mentality that wants to look into complexity or textures of interest or intriguing things, but isn't looking for something to identify with. Isn't looking for a prop, in fact. So it's actually appealing to people whose psychology is actually quite worked out and aren't dependent on external things to give them a sense of self. And most mass culture is to do with marketing identities that complete gaps which people feel they have, which is why it's not actually culture that's worth investigating, since it's actually got a therapeutic function or a fix-it function within this system. And I think what we're saying is we want to remove all those fixes so that we can see the real gaps in people's lives so that they could do something to actually change them rather than using it like a drug.
Yeah, I was just going to say that you're not going to be too interested in your neighbor's medical anesthetics they take, the drugs. You maybe, if they're a dangerous person, if they're not on them, you hope they keep taking them. And that's what modern culture is. It's all therapeutic. And we don't have to be in that situation. So when you talk about a person who's interested in exploring the type that might be interested in spending his awake, he is forced to deal. He cannot go into that as an elitist or is trying to be an individual, unique phenomenon. Mm. You, in a fittings weight group, are forced to, you're all cancelled out, and everybody's on equal footing of nothing.
That's what I've always found in a Finnegan's weight reading group. You always find that somebody who knows about, I don't know, the inside of a car can tell you, well, actually, this works like that and this word. Whereas if you look at the kind of, often Joyce is bracketed with other writers who, in the early 20th century, writers were allowed more, allowed to create less social work, in the sense that they were allowed to create completely incomprehensible architected things like Pound's Cantos or The Wasteland or what have you. But so they all get swept into the same thing, and it gets taught on literature courses as if they're all doing exactly the same thing. Whereas I think the works of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot are designed to flatter a certain sense of cultural expertise and elitism in a way that Joyce undermines that.
Exactly. They are the Lewis, Pound, Eliot, and maybe Yeats are the four analysts, the four old men, and he's piercing them. He's making fun of them. Because he had solved the problem of communication that they failed at. I mean, it's the most democratic. You can bring anybody into a Finnegan's Wake group. You know, someone who's a janitor and knows a lot of stuff about cleaning supplies. They will find that in the book. And then they will talk, and you'll find out about janitoring that you didn't know. So it's the most United Nations evoking of the group knowledge that's hidden in language.
But this is extremely subversive to most people's sense of what's culturally valuable, because I'd say that most people's idea of what's culturally valuable is something which shows that you're a better person than the next person. You know, that if you remove
like
that...
What Esther says, these classical musicians are like Christians. They're trying to save themselves or be isolated or to protect themselves from the dirt. And Joyce really undermines that.
Yeah, which is why it's like rock and roll, in the sense that the blues musician is appealing to something which is not the trained musician, but somebody who will admit that these things affect their body. So it's appealing for a kind of education in de-education, or getting rid of repression, which was the kind of really the 60s idea, which has been so abused since then as sexist and oppressive and bad. And this 60s idea that education might be as much about de-programming ourselves as it is about building something up has been like attacked and attacked in every sort of area that I can think of. That if you hold on to that idea, you're told that you're naive and you have a metaphysics of presence, that you actually believe in the world, and that this shows that you are incredibly metaphysical because you have an a priori belief in a world and a body and emotions that are prior to talking about them. And of course this is nonsense because you can't prove they exist. And this goes back to the old idealist argument which Socrates had to deal with, that came from the Sophists. It's a very old philosophical trope, an old argument. Where does that leave us?
Okay, so it's called, McLuhan wrote about that, the Sophists against the Dialecticians, the ancient quarrel in modern America. And he saw that in Finnegan's Wake, and that is in the classroom section of the school book section of Finnegan's Wake. But the thing is, not only is it creates an environment in the moment for any group of people of the ecology of consciousness or the ecology of perception or the training of perception, it actually also, as McLuhan saw, was a warning about why this would all be undermined with new technological environments coming in, which is what undid the 60s. The digital world changed the world from what the 60s thought was coming.
Oh.
All right, in the counterculture. And McLuhan and the Finney's Wake is useful for even you warning you on that point. And if you really get into it, as follow what McLuhan, how he cracked it, it tells us a lot, as well as, how could you beat that? It provides an environment of the most democratic or hedonistic impulses, or whatever you want to call it, you're into, your joy, ecstasy, and at the same time provides a form of knowledge that all the social sciences were yearning for. It actually figures out how cultures are created, shows you how it's done, and shows you the drama of cognition within it. I mean, you can't ask more. That's way better than the Bible.
I want to restate what you're saying in completely different terms, and I wonder if you can see a parallel with it, which is what I don't like about the way 60s rock culture developed was basically, can be summed up with two words, which is Rolling Stone. And what I dislike about that is the sense of understanding and owning the music developed by people whose actual writing is doing nothing on the level of the music that they're describing. Everything's pushed out into the music, and so that you get descriptions of music as being moving and passionate and relevant and political and social and so on, but described in a way in which the language being used to describe it is the very opposite of anything that could be at all like Finnegan's Wake. And I get alerted to where music is interesting, where suddenly the language being used to describe it has some of the exciting obscurity and denseness and light and shade of a work of literature like Finnegan's Wake. What I mean is that for the person who's glimpsed what language can do, who's drunk at the drunken language of Finnegan's Wake, they're going to find reading Rolling Stone extremely disappointing. Whereas there is a possibility of writing about music and a possibility of a kind of journalism which would be rich in the way that language is rich, and we glimpse that a little bit in the counterculture with some of the writing in Oz or some of the science fiction which appeared between about 67 and 71, that in those high years of social unrest, all sorts of popular forms developed this quality. Experimental science fiction went absolutely ballistic in those years. You can pick up books which are just extraordinary, that they're in paperback with garish covers and everybody was reading, that you can't believe with the kind of close down after that, the kind of streamlining of culture, which is all about obedience and respect for some kind of skillful writing which is outside your own creativity in dealing with incomprehension. I think it's incomprehension is the thing which you have an elitist idea that incomprehension is a thing which holds back the masses from appreciating something, whereas in fact incomprehension is the carrot on the stick. It's where you don't understand something that you become curious. That's the thing that's irritating and that draws you on. And so if something has nothing incomprehensible in it, there's nothing for you to do. And in fact, it's boring. And the confusion over that issue puts people at sea with understanding what you mean when you say you like fitting his weight, because regularly it gets thrown back to me that that's an elitist position, whereas I'm saying it's actually the position that wipes that out that's elitist.
Yeah, you wouldn't know it's elitist unless you joined a fitting his weight group. You see, and I've been in many groups of the fitting his weight reading groups, and the newbie comes in and he's shy. He says, "Well, this is very hard to understand," and then he just sits through and doesn't contribute much, just watches, gets used to the language. And within several sessions, they start to realize, Jesus, nobody here knows what's going on. Maybe I could say something. And they actually get their power back in relation to a group. And all the inferior complexes goes away in relation to thinking culture is elitist. And you got to be smart for it. So, yes, yeah, I agree. Finney's Wake undermines the very thing that people think it looks like.
Yeah.
But they haven't experienced the group yet. I want to mention the other thing is that a person who agreed with you about the Rolling Stone, you mean Rolling Stone magazine, right?
Yeah.
And its effect in 67, 68 was Richard Meltzer. He's a very interesting guy. You read his rock criticism. It is, he doesn't know it, I don't think. He never says it, but he understands that Finding Its Wake, or that rock and roll in print, Finding Its Wake, he tries to write that. He doesn't even know he's redoing Finding Its Wake. But he says that rock died in 68. Okay, so then he kept staying in the game, but he wrote some surrealistic, wacky reviews that the record industry kicked him out. So he's a symptom of showing that something took it over in 68, 69. You know what I mean? A corporate thing. And the music, a lot of great music was made, but the social meaning of it was gone. The social revolutionary. And then you could get into, McLuhan had a larger view of why that would happen. And that has to be considered, the huge superstructure of media. And then you get into individual expression and the Ken Fox response. That's okay. So I'm just saying that Richard Meltzer, it's interesting to read his stuff and how he responded. And he came up with exactly the point that you're a replay of Richard Meltzer, Ben. And you haven't read him.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear. I always feel if two people agree on something without having read each other, it's not a criticism of them. It's more an illustration of the objectivity of what they're saying, that these particular points of view are not the result of our identity, but the result of our imagination of the isomplastic whole, and therefore is immortal.
Yeah, the isomplastic whole, that's the phrase I'm looking for when I said superstructure. But yes, no, I agree with what you just said. You can arrive, that's the unifying point. You actually can have objective perception of what's going on besides your hypersubjectivity.
And once you've understood that there is a one which is happening all around us, and then you understand that any fragment of it, if seen in the light of the whole, can illustrate it, is a way of seeing it. And then this is where chance and randomness come in, because you realize that chance and random activities and sourcing materials at random is actually the thing which challenges your own sense of the whole and actually makes you do work to find what the whole is, in a way that if you just tick over your concepts of what the whole is without challenging it with something chosen at random from the environment, you're no longer imagining what the whole is. And this is the reason why radical modern art needs randomness, and this is confused with nihilism by the classically trained people, who just see this as a love of nonsense for its own sake. But it's actually because of the challenge to the attempt to imagine the whole in a real sense. That's why it's there. It's not there simply because one's running away from any attempt at comprehension.
Exactly. I as you were saying, I was thinking, people, if you want to start a religion, I'd start a religion around Finnegan's Wake. And, you know, you have to go to church every week, and you got to have a Finnegan's Wake group. Now, here's the thing. You would not have the same group. If you end up going to a Finnegan's Wake group, after a while, a pecking order comes in. And depending on people's biases, it's like the group we went to when I was there in April 2008. You know, it was a control group eventually. You need to have different people form the group and start again with Finnegan's Wake. You know what I mean? Every time you open the book, you're starting a game. We haven't got any progress on it, but let's try it again. So that would be, you see my point there?
Yeah, well, it's the opposite of having someone tell you what something means. It's it's because that isn't really particularly interesting. I mean, this is the problem with expertise. I mean, I've had moments where I've brushed with becoming an expert on jazz music. And actually, it's toxic. You know, that expertise in that area is nearly always a very partial set of experiences, a partial set of exposure to a few gigs and a few records, which the person then turns into some kind of legislative point of view. Whereas an honest record of an individual response, if shared, can allow people to develop an objective understanding, because you understand your own relation to the whole. I mean, it's not that it isn't that we are saying we don't want to understand the whole or that we're running away from it. We're not postmodernists who say any talk of totality is terrible and totalitarian, are we?
No, you see the whole unfolding and you participate in it. The tribal people used to say, I participate, we participate, the sun. You participate in the situation. That's the wholeness. And it always creates synchronicity that makes you think there's something connecting you beyond yourself. That's inevitable in a creative situation. Mm. And that's always what happens when you get a group of Phoenix Wake. Everybody starts seeing synchronicity in their own lives in the book.
Mm. Yeah.
It's a living environment. It is actually a great TV show, a great radio program, a great movie, great opera, a great book, a great everything, great baseball game, and it's in it. And you are the center of it.
Yeah, you're the center of it, Bob. But you're breaking up, so I've got to stop the recording there and re-hook up our Skype. Hang on. I mean, I find what you're saying helpful because it's. I've always thought that there's something in Finnegan's Wake which is beyond just a book I like. There's something that makes me want to tell everybody they ought to read it, they ought to experience it. Not because when they've read it they'll come out like me, but because here is a something you should dive into and experience, because we don't have very long to live on this planet, and if you haven't experienced that, then what have you been doing? in the same way as I want people to experience the musics that I've been through. But somehow the musical side is always being considered something easy. I mean, this is partly my own background with educated English parents, that if you put on a record, you're not really doing anything. You're just sort of absorbing something. Whereas if you're reading, you're kind of being active, and it's a good thing to do. Whereas I don't really accept that, because I think to experience... the records that I've experienced, the amount of out I've had to do in terms of my life and my normal set of expectations has been gigantic. You know, they're far harder work than simply absorbing another book.
Yes, and when I think of reading your poetry and the stuff you read on your show, it just occurred to me, I'm not interested in that. But what you're writing should be presented in a group like Finnegan's Wake, and then people react together to it.
Yeah,
well, you're actually producing group writing, which actually fits into your values.
Yeah, but at one time it was a group, because when I first started thinking about Zappa, it meant going to see someone called Danny Houston and having arguments and ideas. And my idea was always that should be funneled down and put in print, so other people could join in this kind of listening session. I mean, for me, listening to records has always been a matter of sitting around, enjoying yourselves, drinking, playing records, and arguing with people about what record to play next and whether anything's any good or not, and being persuaded by other people this record you thought was good is actually rubbish because it sounds like this, or it's actually very good because of that, and altering your aesthetic choices because of what the collective argument is doing. That's where good music writing comes from, and you can always tell the music writer who's actually fallen out of that and become the kind of the guy who's
a point of view. But let me say this. You know, McLuhan said that conversation, he liked the drama of conversation, and conversation is the best. And what he meant was, that's the greatest art, speech, this most democratic art. That's what you're advocating.
Yeah.
You don't sit around and consume. You see what conversation it sparks. Any cultural event is for that. And people say, I like going to movies and talking about it after. It's the talking. That's basically what humans are. They really love talking. And you can use culture not to to stop conversation. Yeah. It has to be argued with or countered or see what happens. So if that's what you're, that's what our revolution is about. And the world's so tiny now, conversation can rule.
But in order to get conversation to happen, we need to fire off blocks to the blocks and blockers. We need objects, and I think non-standard language has an effect that if you get the intensity created by, for example, J.H. Prin has created a community of people who all argue with each other, that Dumitrescu doing his music in that way, producing this kind of obstacle to the assumption that that we all know what the good music is, that this problem created by some artists, for me, is the thing that creates community. And if you try and create community without that, you leave something out, a critical spirit, a demand for something, some experience which enters your subjectivity. I mean, because there are many attempts to create community which have no real place for any special art. They just say, well, let's have some salsa, you know, let's have some, some sort of nice music that everyone will enjoy. And for me, it's just when you have the music that people don't enjoy that everybody starts talking. That's why I like it. That's why I like the problems of the avant-garde. Because the kind of music that just creates community, which no one has any problem with it, it's merely pleasant, doesn't make people talk.
In other words, for you, talk is the most valuable art.
Yeah, it's where, I mean, what I value most about political demonstrations is where you're walking down the street and there's someone else with a banner going to the same demonstration. You say, wherever you've come from, and you manage to break down this absurdity, which is you don't talk to each other in this society when we're all experiencing incredibly similar things.
Right, and while we're talking about this, I've got Mick Jagger in my mind. What's your opinion of Mick Jagger? What's he doing? Is he helping us?
I don't think he's helping much. No, I kind of have affection for him simply because of his singing stance and he saw a guy prancing around. Were you the one telling me about this? You know, the particular Mick Jagger dance he copied off somebody, and that mode of behaviour.
Oh, yeah, George Gamelski at the club,
that and because my brother used to imitate Mick Jagger up and down the kitchen, and it's a whole physical spasm that you do when you respond to R&B music. But I find that whole thing very funny and helps me articulate how I feel about Muddy Waters music. And so Mick Jagger's one of the people that helped me understand Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, and I can't forget that despite all the terrible things he's done in his life.
Yeah, well, like, I don't know what he's doing now. Is he reported on in the London press anymore?
No, I haven't heard about him for years.
He's laying low.
Yeah.
He's hiding out.
Yeah.
And you say his life activities became negative.
Well, it doesn't seem to have...
He's a screw-up if he doesn't join our Finning's Wake group.
Absolutely.
I think our group, our revolution, is the standard-bearer for civil interaction.
Yeah, that's it. And I think, I always found it difficult being a music journalist, where I was always asking musicians to measure up to my sense of what's culturally interesting rather than going and worshipping at their feet.
Yeah, you went in to the specialists and tried to make them comprehensive by reminding them, hey, the whole point of this is to have speech and discussion.
Yeah, that's
you're great, you stimulate discussion, but hey, are you ready to talk?
Yeah, yeah, yourselves.
Yeah, yourselves. Yeah. And users, they're not.
Yeah, and the kind of conceit induced in money-making people by their managers and the sort of cocoon that they're put in because they have this ability, because they have the fame to generate cash, is kind of repulsive. There's a certain atmosphere around those people which flatters them, and they become kind of nauseating. And everybody knows this, which is why...
Yeah,
people
everybody knows this.
Become grotesque.
Leonard Cohen saying that.
Yeah.
It's friendly fascism. But what's interesting is that the reason people put up with it is that it was a new technological medium, a new extension of the sensory life that hypnotized them, and they enjoyed the play of seeing rock on TV and whatever other media we have today. That's all new. That glitters. That distracts you from the bugaboo of the friendly fascism.
That is what our revolution's about.
Yes, that's what it is.
Good. We finally told everyone. Thanks very much, Bob. That was. Thank you very much for talking for an hour with me. That was Bob Dobbs. My name's Ben Watson, and you've been listening to the Bob and Ben Show. And that was the 26th episode. Please join us next week. Bye.